I do want to mention, too, that we are having lunch afterwards, and if you have not yet made plans and forgot to do this or are just visiting for the first time, certainly we can squeeze you in. Just talk to Lynn and we'll get that done, so don't worry about that. We sung several beautiful hymns today, and we just finished singing a very lovely hymn right now when we sing, O Lord, Thou art my God and King. And we talk about exalting God, proclaiming Him, blessing Him, and all of the mercies that He has shown. And we go on saying that thy kingdom's glory they shall show, and we show, and thy power also tell. And that's what we are striving to do in the work of God, and tell of the power of God, of the coming kingdom of God, of the glory of God. We also sang on page number 6, Praise You, the Lord, the Almighty. This is written in Germany many years ago, but it reflects the words of the Bible. We are to praise the Lord, the Almighty, the King of creation. O my soul, praise Him, for He is your health and salvation. All you who hear, now to His temple draw near. I wonder if we understand what we say when we sing these words. I wonder if we know what these words are talking about. I wonder if we understand who the Almighty is and who the God is and the Lord is that we are praising and that we're looking forward to coming and in the very near future. What is this all about? What is all happening? There are enormous thoughts expressed in these hymns. And for myself, I know that I don't often enough seriously sit down and ask myself, what do these words say? And do I understand what these words are all about? On the holy days, we are to increase in our understanding, to grow in grace and knowledge and in understanding. And so we come to this very special day, the Feast of Trumpets, and we recognize it as being a day which has tremendous meaning in the future, the coming of Jesus Christ to this earth a second time. And we will focus on that. Mr. Nias will be speaking on that, I believe, in the afternoon. But I wonder if we understand about this Jesus Christ and where He came from and what He was and what this day really portends and what it looks back on, let alone looks forward to. And if we understand that it's all wrapped together in one package, because it in fact is all wrapped together in a remarkable way. In the book of Corinthians, Paul, who was not an eyewitness to the life and suffering and death and resurrection of Jesus Christ, Paul, who was brought in a little later on, was told about all of this and believed it. Now, he was taught by Christ personally in the deserts, but Paul was very, very excited about what he was learning and seeing. And he wrote in 1 Corinthians chapter 2, really the whole chapter has got so very much to talk about his marveling at the understanding. He says in verse 1, I, brethren, when I came to you, did not come with excellence of speech or of wisdom declaring to you the testimony of God, for I determined not to know anything among you except Jesus Christ and Him crucified. Now, of course, he didn't mean just remaining crucified. He knew the resurrected Christ. That's what taught him. But that's where his focus was, on this Christ that he was teaching, that he had learned from. He says, I was with you in weakness, in fear, and in much trembling, and my speech and my preaching were not with persuasive words of human wisdom, but in demonstration of the Spirit and power. And so Paul could do miracles of healing. People who he could resurrect the dead at times and was able to do that and do various things like that. But he said, your faith, in verse 5, should not be in the wisdom of men, but in the power of God. Now, God does expect us to use our minds, and He does expect us to think. So the wisdom of men is vital, provided it is wrapped up and clothed in the wisdom of God. That's when it has meaning. But in all of this, you and I have been created with a mind that was blank at birth, with the odd exception of perhaps some little bits and pieces of instinct, like you could feed yourself and breathe and those things, but it was blank, and we had to learn to be educated. And it takes a lot of years for that mind to be educated. It takes actually a lifetime. And the marvel is that the body gets old, but the mind continues to develop and continues to be educated and grows in strength and comprehension and in understanding. That's why the gray-haired ones are to sit at the city gates. They're supposed to have the answers for the young ones. And if the world ever learns to respect the elderly people who've lived their lives and experienced so very much, and give them the respect that they deserve, it'll be a much better world, because the lessons don't have to be learned and relearned and relearned. But he goes on to say in verse 9, as it is written, eye has not seen, nor ear heard, nor have entered into the heart of man the things which God has prepared for those who love him. But God has revealed them to us through his Spirit, for the Spirit searches all things, yes, the deep things of God. There are deep things of God. And there are things that are so deep that this little brain just doesn't understand it. Can't understand it. Even Jesus Christ said he didn't know when he was to return. The hour of his coming, he didn't know that. He also said that he didn't call people. He didn't convert people. God the Father did that. So we're in a far further boat removed, you might say, from God than Jesus Christ was. There are so much of the deep things of God that we do not understand. Now, there are many things he does teach us as well. He says in verse 11, for what man knows the things of a man except the spirit of the man which is in him? Even so, no one knows the things of God except the Spirit of God, or except by the Spirit of God. But clearly from the Scriptures, God doesn't just lay the whole thing out for us in a simple package. It is laid out in a very complicated way, and many times so that we shouldn't understand certain things. And so the Bible is written here a little and there a little, so people can read it and stumble and fall backwards and be taken. And we have to be very careful then in our comprehension, in our understanding. It says in verse 12, we have received not the spirit of the world, but the spirit which is, or it says who, but which is from God, that we might know the things that have been freely given to us by God. So this should tell us that there are some things God has given to understand, and there are some things he has not yet given to understand. And no matter how hard you and I try, any guess that we have about when we are resurrected as spirit beings in the family of God is a guess. It's not the reality of it. It'll be greater than anything we can possibly imagine with this brain of ours. It's hard for us to comprehend that. So there are things then which God doesn't always clearly state to us. Verse 14, the natural man doesn't receive the Spirit of God for their foolishness to him, the things of the Spirit of God, nor can he know them because they are spiritually discerned. But he who is spiritual judges all things, yet he himself is rightly judged by no one. For who has the mind of the Lord that he may instruct him? But we have the mind of Christ. So Jesus Christ has entered this world into your life and mine to give us deeper understanding. Deeper doesn't mean complete. It doesn't mean total understanding. It means deeper understanding. And I do have to admit that there are things that I struggle with in comprehension, that I simply have to put on the shelf and not at this in this life, in this flesh, be able to totally comprehend. One of them is that I should be a spirit being in the family of God. That's a wonderful future. To live for eternity, that I can get a little bit of a handle on, you know. But how it's going to be, what it's going to be like is quite amazing. I spoke to my aunt, who's a Jehovah Witness, yesterday, and she believes that you'll live as a physical human being like we are now for all eternity. It's an amazing thing when you think that life is that limited, to live as a physical human being for all eternity. And it shows you how limited the mind is. It just seems impossible to think that you receive a spirit, powerful body, spirit body, powerful body, a mind that has no limit to learning or to thinking or to understanding or to comprehending or to communicating, and an understanding of God which is so much greater than what we have right now that it's breathtaking in its scope. So humans come up with all kinds of other thoughts and ideas. I heard a lady in the church once say, well, I hope when I'm resurrected that God puts me right next to my husband who'll be resurrected so he can tell me what to do. Boy, you know. Whoa, that's really a mouthful, isn't it, you think? This day is very special. It is very likely the day that Christ was born, or very nearly where he was born. He was not born December the 25th. We should celebrate the birth of Christ. It's a wonderful thing to understand and comprehend. But we don't have a given day to celebrate it on unless he happened to be born in the Feast of Trumpets. And we celebrate this day thinking of the coming of the Lord. And we can show from the Scriptures that very likely Christ was born in early September. And it is an interesting thing. Someone mentioned to me the other day that the Catholic Church believes that the Immaculate Conception occurred December the 9th. Now, that's what someone told me, so I'm not positive. But if you just go together and add 9 months to December the 9th, you come to around September the 9th. And that does make you wonder just a little bit, why do you take December the 25th then, you know, for the celebrations? That's by the side, and I haven't got the verification or the proof of that. But it's an interesting thought. Let's go back, though, to the book of Luke and look at a few points, and I'm only going to be very brief with this. We do try to keep the services a little shorter when there's two services a day, so we'll try to keep this brief and yet give you the information I would like to pass on to you and that I trust God wants us all to have. In Luke chapter 1, and in verse 5, and in verse 8 it says, "These were the days. There were in the days of Herod, the king of Judah, a certain priest named Zacharias of the division of Abijah. His wife was the daughter of Aaron, and her name was Elizabeth." Now the order of Elijah served in the temple in a certain structured order every year. And so we can verify that he was working in the temple about June, and his wife became pregnant shortly after that, probably in the beginning of July. That would be Elizabeth being pregnant with John the Baptist, who became John the Baptist. If you jump ahead to verse 26, it says, "In the sixth month of John the Baptist, the angel Gabriel was sent by God to a city of Galilee named Nazareth to a virgin betrothed to a man whose name was Joseph of the house of David. The virgin's name was Mary." And of course, here is where Mary then conceives. If you add from June, 6 months to June, you get about December, when she conceived the Jesus Christ. And then going down to verse 56, I gave a much more detailed sermon on this some time ago, so I don't want to repeat all of that. But verse 56 says, "Mary remained with Elizabeth about 3 months and then went home." So she was 3 months pregnant by the time she went home and John the Baptist was born. And John the Baptist was born right around the spring holy day span of time. Christ was born then 6 months later. Elizabeth's full time came for her to be delivered. She brought forth a son. So we can understand then that John was born in the spring of 4 BC and Christ was born probably September, and I'm guessing a little when I would say on the Feast of Trumpets. But there was a very special day where Joseph and Mary went to Bethlehem, which was their hometown, Joseph's hometown. They said for a census that was being taken by the Romans, but also they would be smart to take a census when people went to their homes, because that's where they had their inheritances and their lands and so on and so forth. But the inns were all full, the hotels and motels were all full, because Bethlehem is 5 miles away from Jerusalem and the temple. And if you have maybe 1 million people coming there to keep a holy day, you're going to fill up all the motels and all the towns around Jerusalem. So the possibility is enhanced even by that understanding, that Jesus Christ was born around the beginning of September, and it could possibly have been on the Feast of Trumpets. That's what this day means. It means the coming of the Lord. It represents the coming of the Lord. We'll see a few other points about this. Now, in Luke chapter 3 and verse 23, there's other meanings attached to it, of course, but in Luke chapter 3 and in verse 23, it says, "Jesus himself began his ministry of about 30 years of age, being, as supposed, the son of Joseph." Now, he wasn't the son of Joseph. He was the son of God. His mother was Mary. And at 30 years of age, Jesus Christ began his ministry. But at the age of 12, as he already said, "I must be about my father's work." So it isn't that Christ was just a man growing up to 30, and then suddenly a call came and a change came, and now he began a ministry. No, that never ever stopped. Never stopped from the moment he was born. And yet, when Christ was born, he was a little baby. Just like Ashley and Savannah were here when we laid hands on them and asked God's blessing on them not long ago. Little babies. And you see them growing, you know, their minds working every day, but they're still little babies, little children. It's wonderful to see it. And it's an amazing thing that it takes the human being, you know, 25 years, they say, for the mind to fully mature. And perhaps that's why in the temple you couldn't serve until you were 25 years of age, and then you served as an apprentice and really started serving at the age of 30. So Christ began his ministry at the age of 30. There's something to that, that God knew long before the psychologists came up with the idea of the human mind being mature at the age of 25. God knew something more, much more about that. We can read in, going back to Luke chapter 2, we can read in the first couple of verses, "It came to pass in those days a decree went out from Caesar Augustus that all the world should be registered." Now, obviously, and this is what we need to understand in the Bible, many times it says all the world. It doesn't mean China and Australia and Tasmania and South America. You know, all the world doesn't mean that. It means the Roman world, all the Roman world, all the Roman control had to be registered, or all that area had to be registered. And the census first took place while Quirinius was governing in Syria. There were two, apparently. Josephus talks about this, and one was very likely than the one in 4 B.C. It probably coincided with people going to their hometowns to be registered, and then also, in Joseph's case, to be in Jerusalem or Bethlehem where Christ was to have been born. And God brought that all into play because of the prophecies. In verse 8 it says, there were in the same country shepherds living out in the fields, keeping watch over their flock by night. And in the Bethlehem area, you didn't stay in the fields in December or January, or February, or March. As a matter of fact, in March in 1992, when I was in Israel, in early March, they had 2 feet of snow in Jerusalem. So they'd get some big snowstorms, and they'd get cold weather, and they'd get rain, and they'd get all those kind of things. So this was not to December, this would have been September, when the shepherds were still with their flocks. And they were the ones that went to see Jesus Christ. An angel of God stood before them, and the glory of the Lord shone around them, and they were afraid. This angel came. Angels often carry trumpets with them. Angels often make sounds and proclaim the coming of the Lord. They were afraid, and the angel says, don't be afraid. I bring you good tidings of great joy, which will be to all people. You know, when Christ returns, there will be great fear for some, not for all. There are some who are not afraid at the coming of God, at the coming of Christ. But you know, when you read these words, and you realize that something happened here, which is difficult to understand. Difficult when you put it in tune with John. Let's go to John chapter 1. It's amazing that I was about, must have been something like 24 years old, 26 perhaps. I'd gone to church almost all my life. Never read John chapter 1 and verse 1. It's amazing. But it says in John chapter 1 and verse 1, in the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, and the Word was God. You wrestle with that for a little while. And I wrestle with that for a little while. He was in the beginning with God. All things were made through that Word, that Logos, through Him. Without Him, nothing was made that was made. Nothing was made that wasn't made without that Logos and the Word, not Adam and Eve. They weren't created without the Logos and the Word being there. Not the universe, not even Lucifer and all of the angels and Michael and Gabriel. All of that was created that the Word had to be there with God, and the Word was God. It's so interesting when you try to wrap your mind around this and understand that you cannot separate the Logos from God or the Father. They are one. And how do you understand that? How do you comprehend that? We think in terms of physical. It's difficult to think in spiritual terms. But he says, in him was life, and the life was the light of men. Then he goes on saying a bit further in verse 5, the light shines in the darkness. The darkness didn't comprehend it. The Logos and the Word shone in the darkness. That light, which was in the beginning, and the world didn't comprehend it. There was a man sent from God, his name was John. He gave him a witness to the light, and the light wasn't understood. In verse 10, he was in the world, and the world was made through him, and the world did not know him. He came to his own, and his own did not receive him. Now we're talking not about anything we don't comprehend. Suddenly we're understanding the Logos and the Word became flesh, became a baby, became Jesus Christ. And his own rejected him. His chosen people of Israel rejected him. And the world which he created didn't know he was the creator. But as many as received him, to them he gave the right to become children of God, to those who believe in his name. That's Jesus Christ who did that. That is the Logos and the Word. But you can't separate that from the Father. And that's the interesting question. We read and sing these psalms about God the Almighty, the creator of all things. And what do we think about? What's our concept of God? How do we comprehend this? It says in verse 14, the Word, the Logos, became flesh and dwelt among us, and we beheld his glory as the glory of the only begotten of the Father, full of grace and truth. And so then we ask ourselves some questions, and we ask ourselves, well, is this the first time that the Logos and the Word showed up then on the earth and became a baby and a child and walked with man. Is that what occurred? And isn't it marvelous if it should have occurred at the Feast of Trumpets? Is it a marvelous thing? Is it a possible thing? If we go back to John 17, where Jesus gave his maybe not the last prayer, but the last large prayer that is fully recorded. It's a marvel that this prayer is even recorded. Of course, it was inspired by Jesus Christ to be remembered by John and recorded decades after the death of Christ. So in John 17, here's what Jesus says when he speaks to God the Father. He says, I have glorified you on the earth. I have finished the work which you have given me to do. And at our dying breath, I hope we can say that. People like Mary Cooper could say that. Kathy Harrison, who was with us not long ago, could say that too. And of course, Gerald Waterhouse. And now, O Father, Jesus said, glorify me together with yourself with the glory which I had with you before the world was. How do you figure that out? Something did happen. Something very unusual and different happened when that baby was born. Because then you had a physical entity, which was Jesus Christ, the Logos and the Word, a physical entity that couldn't really think even. Isn't it amazing to think that the Logos and the Word became a cell, two cells, and then finally became flesh and couldn't think until it was educated and taught for 25 years? That's stretching it a bit. Didn't take that long. About 12 years of age, he astonished and astounded, you know, some of the scribes in the temple. So he was a brilliant young boy. It's like some of our teenagers are. You know, it scares me how smart the kids are these days. It makes me feel kind of slow. But that's all right. I'm going to have the white hair before they do, you see. But give me the glory which I had with you before the world was. Now, when he said things like this, the apostles were astonished. There was something in the apostles. You see, they grew up in Jewish homes and Jewish beliefs, and you did not dare make yourself equal with God or mention anything. Christ said, God is my Father. And oh, right away, you know, they were ready to throw stones at him, the society. So his disciples, you know, their minds just kept shutting off. Whenever he began saying things like this, they didn't understand it. They kept shutting off their minds and didn't comprehend the magnitude of what he was telling them, just like we are sometimes, or we do sometimes. You know, when we've got things that block our thinking, that don't allow us to expand our minds, or else maybe take us in a direction we shouldn't be going in, depending on how biased and prejudiced we are. And so we see in this world, you know, on crucifixes, you see black Christs, you see white Christs, you see women, female Christs now. You never see Jewish Christ, though, do you? It never looks like a Jew. You know, it's got to look like something else, some European or something like that. All the places in Europe are full of that. Verse 24 of John 17. Father, he says, I desire that they also whom you gave me may be with me where I am, that they may behold my glory which you have given me, for you loved me before the foundation of the world. That's a long time ago. That's long before there was a world, long before there was a universe, long before there was Lucifer and Michael and Gabriel. Enormous things that are said in here. In Revelation 13, I don't have to turn to this one, I'm sure you know it, but Revelation 13 and verse 8, you know, a big mouthful. All those who dwell on the earth will worship him whose names have not been written in the book of life of the Lamb slain from the foundation of the world. Christ said, you love me from before the foundation of the world. Another one in Matthew 25 is an astonishing statement. Going back to Matthew. When we read these words and we try to understand them, wrestle with them, and yet it's not as easy to comprehend as we would like it to be. Some people say, oh, it's simple. I guess my mind isn't very simple because I have to wrestle with these things and then acknowledge that no matter how hard I think about it, I'm going to have to put some things in the shelf and wait and see because my brain can't understand it, just like my eyes cannot see God. Moses said, let me see you. Let me just have a peek, a little glimpse. And it's an astonishing story. We'll get to that in just a moment. You know, about Moses. He wasn't afraid to go up to Mount Sinai and climb up the top of this smoking, creaking mountain to talk to God. I mean, he was a little bit afraid, I'm sure, you know. But he went again and again and again, and everybody else was petrified. You know, the big valley, they were all gathered by the mountain. They all, first of all, wanted to get close to the mountain. Afterwards, you found them on the other side of the valley as far away as they could get, piled up probably, you know, staying away from that great God who is shaking that mountain over there. Matthew 25 and verse 34 says, "The king will say to those on his right hand, 'Come, you blessed of my Father, inherit the kingdom prepared for you from the foundation of the world.'" So not only did God love the Logos and the Word that became Christ, or did he love Christ at the foundation of the world, he planned already in his kingdom, prepared for you from the foundation of the world. That was already God's plan. See, God doesn't sort of make plans as he goes along to adjust to the things he couldn't control. He's got a big plan that's going to come to pass exactly as he wants it to. Part of that plan certainly is that beings like you and I have to be immersed in the suffering crucible of a world controlled by Satan, so that we come to hate evil and hate sin with every fiber of our being, so that we'll be like God and understand the penalty of sin is death and banishment from God and everything he's ever done, and that's just and fair and right. There are some of these marvelous things, and they're very difficult to understand, some of these things which are written and which we read and we sing about, and we read in the Scriptures. How do we understand them? Let's go to the book of Exodus. Well, I'm sorry. I'll first go to 1 Corinthians 10. Then I'll go to Exodus. 1 Corinthians 10. And again, you know, I was kind of shocked when I read these words. I was looking after a great big Sunday school for the Strathclyde United Church, 600 kids, trying to teach them something from the Bible, and I read these words in here, and I wasn't allowed to teach the Ten Commandments there. Wasn't allowed to do certain things there. And as the minister said to me when I tried to ask him about the Bible, he says, "Well, you know that the first chapters are myth. You can throw those out. Forget those first six or seven chapters of the Bible. They're just myth." And then I thought, well, how much else? Give me a list of things that I can throw out, you know, if you can do that. And of course he could. 1 Corinthians chapter 10, in the first few verses, says, "Moreover, brethren, I do not want you to be unaware that all our fathers were under the cloud and passed through the sea. All were baptized into Moses in the cloud and in the sea, and all ate the same spiritual food." Kind of interesting to say to baptize into Moses, because we're baptized into Christ, aren't we? But of course, Moses here was their spiritual leader, the only one they could comprehend and understand. "And all drank of the same spiritual drink, for they drank of the spiritual rock that followed them, and that rock was Christ." When I first read that, my eyes went that big. How do you understand it? How do we understand and comprehend something like that? "With most of them," that is Israel, "God was not well pleased." Now, who was not well pleased? Christ was the rock. Who is the God that Israel knew? They didn't know the Father, not the way that Christ revealed the Father. And there's one God. Christ said, "We are one." So it's not that he's saying, "Hey, I want you to introduce you to several." It's not that at all. See, our comprehension of one is what's sometimes lacking and gapping, big gaps in there. How do you understand one? Because you don't separate Christ and the Father. You can't separate them. Now, maybe when Christ was a child and was born, you could say, "Well, now I got something to get a hold of." But you remember when Philip said, "Show me the Father. Just let me have a look at the Father." And Christ looked at him with surprise and says, "Have I been so long with you and you still don't know me?" That's an astonishing statement, isn't it? But it's made when you don't understand the oneness of God and the marvel of God. So it went on to say that the spiritual rock which followed them was Christ. Verse 6, "These things became our examples to the intent that we should not lust after evil things." And verse 7, "Do not become idolaters as some of them were," that is, worshiping other gods. So we need to be very, very careful and understand. Verse 9, "Don't let us tempt Christ as some of them tempted Christ." Some of Israel, coming out of Egypt, dragging the idols of Egypt through the Red Sea with them, were tempting Christ. Of course, when you tempt Christ, you tempt God. And it's all the same thing. You don't sin against just Christ. You sin against God. You sin against the Father. You sin against God. All that God is. And what is God? What is all that God is? Well, my mind just sort of stops. I'm waiting to find out. I will know one day. and will be like him. They were destroyed by serpents. And don't complain, as some of them also complained and were destroyed by the destroyer. So we ought not to be doing these things, complaining and so on and so forth. Let's go now to the book of Exodus then. With these points of understanding, let's come to comprehend the fact that the Logos and the Word, which became Christ, which was Christ, had more than one appearance in the earth. It came to the earth more than once, actually dwelt with humans, right from the time of the Garden of Eden. That was Christ that walked in the garden. That was the Logos and the Word. That was God that walked in the garden. And we must not separate God. We must not separate it into entities as we would human flesh, human beings. In Exodus 16 and verse 11, the Lord spoke to Moses. But who spoke to Moses? Well, of course it was God speaking to Moses. It isn't that Jesus Christ would have said here, well, just a second, I'll check with my dad and see if it's okay with him. When Jesus speaks, the Father speaks. When the Father speaks, Jesus speaks. They're one in their thinking, in their attitudes, in their minds, and all that they do. And that oneness is difficult for us to comprehend. So we accept it. We accept that oneness. And we're very careful not to make images. That's why the Bible says, don't make a graven image to represent either the Father, or represent the Son, or represent, now that they do the Trinity, the whole shooting match. God spoke to Moses, saying, I have heard the complaints of the children of Israel. Speak to them, saying, at twilight you shall eat meat, in the morning you shall be filled with bread, and you shall know that I am the Lord your God. What do we know? What did they know? What did they learn? So it was that quails came up at evening and covered the camp. In the morning the dew lay all around the camp, and all of this occurred and happened. Where do I want to get to here? Just a second here. I guess I would skip the verse or two. Chapter 19 is one I wanted to have, not 16. Although 16 fits, but 19 is what I wanted to have. It all fits together. But nevertheless, here in chapter 19, God says to them in verse 5, if you will obey my voice and keep my covenant, you will be a special treasure to me above all people. He's explaining to them what's going to happen. So he called the elders of Israel together and said to them all, I'm going to come and talk with you. I'm going to come and see you. And verse 7, Moses came and called for the elders and laid them before them the words of God. The people answered and said, all the Lord has spoken, we will do. And God got his words back. And then God said in verse 9, behold, I come to you in a thick cloud that the people may hear when I speak with you and believe you forever. So Moses told the words to the people. So God was going to now come to the people of Israel. He was going to appear. So we ask about the second coming of Christ. We always refer to the Feast of Trumpets revealing the second coming of Christ, but in a sense, it isn't the second coming at all. It's only the second coming if you consider the birth of Christ as the first coming of Christ. But who was it that descended on Mount Sinai then? We just finished reading in 1 Corinthians 10. It was Christ that they tempted when they crossed the Red Sea and so on. And Christ was the rock that followed Israel. The Logos and the Word, and through the Logos and the Word, everything was made and created. So can we begin grasping the magnitude of the picture that we see? So Moses told the words to the people, and the Lord said to Moses, go to the people and consecrate them today and tomorrow, and let them wash their clothes and be ready on the third day, in verse 11, for the third day the Lord will come down on Mount Sinai in the sight of all people. That's a little glimpse of what's going to occur when Christ returns. But he came down to Mount Sinai. And the picture that this helps us comprehend. You shall set bounds for the people all around, saying, take heed to yourselves that you do not go up to the mountain or touch its base. Whoever touches the mountain shall be put to death. Not a hand shall touch him, but he shall be stoned or shot with an arrow. Whether man or beast, he shall not live. When the trumpet sounds long, they shall come near the mountain. So this trumpet was to blow. And the trumpet signifies the coming of God, the coming of the Lord. This is the Feast of Trumpets. This particular trumpet wasn't blown on this day, It was blown at an earlier time. So Moses went down from the mountain to the people, sanctified them, they washed their clothes, and he said to the people, be ready on the third day, don't come near your wives. And then it came to pass on the third day in the morning that there were thunders and lightnings. And people just thought, well, this is a nice day to go out there, and we'll walk in this little valley and come up to Mount Sinai, and God's going to come and talk with us. And of course, they got God in their pocket. So their image of God was like this. Or maybe it was bigger if it happened to be a calf. But they didn't imagine the magnitude of God. They didn't imagine the greatness, the majesty of God. They didn't understand what was going to happen here. So it came to pass that there were thunders and lightnings and a thick cloud on the mountain, and the sound of a trumpet began to blow very loud, so that all the people who were in the camp trembled. I asked the children to draw a picture of this mountain, you know, with all quaking and shaking, the clouds on it, and this giant-sized trumpet sort of hovering over the mountain. It must have been really big, you know, to sound waxing louder and louder and louder for the longest time. Moses brought the people out of the camp to meet with God. Who did they meet? Who are they going to meet? And they stood at the foot of the mountain, and Sinai was completely in smoke because the Lord descended upon it in fire. The presence of God on Sinai at that moment was so enormous and magnificent that this mountain just began to quake and shake and to smoke. It didn't quite split in half, which another one's going to do. Its smoke ascended like smoke of a furnace, and the whole mountain quaked greatly. And when the blast of the trumpet sounded long and became louder and louder, Moses spoke, and God answered him by voice. Moses was the only one probably able to speak. Everybody else had their mouth dry and their tongue stuck in the back there somewhere, not able to say anything. But Moses had a different relationship with God. He met him in the desert. He talked with him. He walked with him. He saw him work. He saw a God of compassion and of love and of mercy. He saw the Christ that we see and know and understand, and have therefore the ability to come boldly before his throne. He says, come boldly before my throne. When Christ descends and descended here, Moses went to meet him and climbed up in the mountain to meet him. There's a different sort of a meeting that will take place the next time this trumpet sounds. But the children of God, those who are like Moses, will also ascend to meet him, climb up, and not be afraid. God answered him by voice, and the Lord came down on the Mount Sinai. On the top of the mountain, the Lord called to Moses on the top of the mountain, and Moses went up. Now, if your knees are knocking together like mad, you can't climb mountains. You know, you've got to have yourself pretty well in control to be able to climb that mountain. And the Lord said to Moses, go down and warn the people, lest they break through to gaze at the Lord, and many of them perish. People are curious, but this thing was getting awfully scary for them too. And let the priests who come near God consecrate themselves, lest the Lord break out against them. But Moses said to the Lord, the people cannot come up to Mount Sinai, for you warned us, saying, set bounds around the mountain and consecrate it. So then the Lord said to him, away, get down and then come up, you and Aaron with you. So Moses had legs like Arnold Schwarzenegger after he climbed that mountain so many times. It's an amazing thing when you think about it. God kept saying, get down and come back up, get down and come back up. And if you've ever climbed a mountain, we climbed Ruby Mountain in the summer, you know, I guess Mount Sinai is something like that. Moses must have had legs that are no muscles there, that he just would flex them and rip his shorts, you know, or whatever he would do. But do not let the priests and the people break through or to come up to the Lord, lest he break out against them. So Moses went down to the people and spoke to them. But the people were afraid. When they saw all this happening, they said, Moses, you go and talk to God for us because we are afraid. So that trumpet blew and was powerful and reflected the coming of Jesus Christ. If we can comprehend that, then we should understand the magnificence of what this day means. The book of 1 Peter, I won't turn to that in chapter 1, though, the whole of chapter 1, talks about the precious blood of Christ foreordained before the world began. Now we can understand why obedience is important, and why it is that this day has a history to it. A history that looks forward to an even greater history. An even greater coming, depicted by what this day does mean. We do need to listen and act on what God says. Peter says, he who believes on Christ, that's not always easy. It's not easy to do that. His own followers had great difficulty believing in him. You know, we'll close by going to John 20. In John 20, the disciples of Jesus Christ who saw him do these marvelous works and marvelous deeds still had it in their minds, and he taught them of the Father. And he taught them to pray to the Father in his name. And so in our prayers, we address the Father and we address the Son. They're both together in our prayers, and they ought to be, all of our prayers. I don't recall any other prayers that I have had for 35 years. I always speak to the Father, and I speak through Jesus Christ. And sometimes I will say, and to Christ who is seated at your right hand, and talk that way. But in John chapter 20, we read what happened after the resurrection of Christ. These men who fought against the concept that the Logos and Word had a time long before they were there. As a matter of fact, it says in John 1:1, remember, in the beginning there was the Word. The Word didn't have a beginning. The Word didn't have a beginning. God didn't have a beginning. So when it says in the beginning, it had to be a different beginning. What was that beginning? Well, I'm not sure, but I would guess to say the beginning was where God made the plan for what was going to happen, the purpose, the foundations of the world, and all of that was laid in the beginning. But the Logos and Word and God existed long before any beginning. They never had a beginning. So it's an interesting thing to wrap your minds around. John chapter 20 and verse 21. Jesus Christ rose from the dead, and they saw him walk through walls, and they saw him do all these marvelous things that only God could do. And he said, peace be to you, as the Father has sent me, I send you. A work to do, the work that you and I are part of. And when he said this, he breathed on them and said to them, receive the Holy Spirit. If you forgive the sins of any, they are forgiven them. If you retain the sins of any, they are retained. So a tremendous responsibility is given to the ministry. And Thomas, called the twin, one of the 12, was not with them when Jesus came. The 12, or the 11 that were there, 10 that were there actually, still didn't really comprehend all of this. It says they still doubted. But the other disciples said to Thomas, we have seen the Lord. And so he said to them, unless I see in his hand the print of nails, and put my fingers into the print of the nails, and put my hand into his side, I will not believe. So 8 days passed. 8 days later, his disciples were again inside, and Thomas with them, and Jesus came, the doors being shut, and stood in the midst and said, peace be to you. I'm not sure if he came up from the floor, down through the ceiling, into the sides. He was suddenly there and said, peace be to you. And then he said to Thomas, reach your finger here. He knew what Thomas had said 8 days before that. He wasn't there. He knew it. Well, he was there, of course. And look at my hands, reach your hand here, put it into my side. Do not be unbelieving, but believing. And then Thomas said something which was so enormous in what it meant to Thomas and to the other disciples. And he said it knowing it, I think, academically, seeing it, experiencing it, and yet inside of himself it was unclear. It was still not fully ripe. That's what happens when you are learning something. Suddenly you begin to understand. You say, now I understand, but you don't fully understand. And so God gives us so much to understand about his magnitude and his character, and about the Logos and the Word and the Christ, who came to this earth many, many times. So we understand the second coming in a slightly different way. Thomas took him by the feet and said, my Lord and my God. And that's what Jesus Christ is. That's what he was from before the foundations of the earth. And Jesus said to him, that is, God said to him, Thomas, because you've seen me, you've believed. It's a bit easier. If you can see me, you can see the holes and so on, you've believed. Blessed are those who have not seen and yet believed. And that's where we're at, that belief based upon the witness of these wonderful followers of God.
Okay, so after this closing hymn, we will close with prayer. Mr. Dave Davis will come forward and ask for a blessing on our new meal. So please stand, and we'll turn to page number 73 together. And we'll sing Seek Ye First, talking about that coming kingdom of God. Page number 73, Seek Ye First.